Hello and welcome to Every Woman. I'm Fiona Nowling, and with me in the studio today is my lovely wife Una Nowling, Ember Urbach, and at the engineering board we have Christina Fraser. And our guest today will be joining us by phone, Laura Markowitz, a feminist thinker, journalist and novelist. And we'd really like to welcome her to the show. Laura, can you hear me?
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me here.
Thank you very much for joining us. I read your bio and I'm very excited to have you on, so I'm going to give a tiny snippet of your bio to our listeners.
And okay, great.
In the 80s, she had a Watson Fellowship to investigate how women make space for themselves in patriarchal religions, and lived in Russian Orthodox and Catholic convents around the world, attended a women's yeshiva in Jerusalem, and lived with and helped organize Buddhist nuns in Sri Lanka and Thailand. Since then, she's been a journalist, a family therapist, and worked in magazines for 2 decades, including publishing a queer family magazine for a decade, In the Family, which looked at the intersections of gender, race, class, sexual orientation, and homophobia and heterosexism. These days, she's involved in public radio and TV and is a published young adult author with her series, Book of the Sky God. So, Laura, welcome to Every Woman, and I know I gave our listeners a brief introduction to you, but can you give them a bit of background information about yourself?
Sure. Well, I'm speaking to you from Tucson, Arizona. I'm originally from the East Coast and moved out here about 15 years ago. And these days I do 3 or 4 things. I work independently, writing, ghostwriting, and doing developmental editing for book authors. And I still do a lot of magazine writing. And then I'm a contributing producer for Arizona Public Media, which is our NPR and PBS stations. So what I feel so privileged to have big platforms to tell stories that I hope are putting out really important ideas in the world. I think the biggest influence in my life has been feminism, and then almost quite as big has been Buddhism. So, you know, I really feel like the enlightened future we can have comes through understanding, and feminism is certainly, you know, a great place to start understanding how we can evolve ourselves to be happier, more compassionate, more wise.
Thank you. And we'd really like to talk to you about your experiences with the Watson Fellowship and your time doing that, or the cultures and different religions and experiences you had.
Sure. Well, I was a comparative religion major in college. I went to Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania. It's a small liberal arts, somewhat Quaker-identified school, although not exactly Quaker. But what I was so curious about was why, I mean, I grew up Jewish, Reconstructionist Jewish, and if for people who don't know, Reconstructionist is kind of an odd form of Judaism. It was feminist from when it started in the early 1900s. And it sees tradition as having a vote but not a veto. So you see your religion as you're part of a living civilization and you must participate in evolving it. Mm. So I came into the study of religion with this idea like, wow, well, if something isn't fair or isn't right or doesn't work, why stay with it? You know, it's our job to rewrite it. Let's rewrite that prayer. Let's rewrite that idea of enemy, whatever we need to do. Let's make it better. That's part of our job. And so studying comparative religion was kind of a bit of a shock of thinking like, wow, why do women, here it is the 1980s, we know about feminism, why would they want to become nuns in any religion, or Orthodox Jews in my religion? What's the appeal? Why would you volunteer to be relegated to a second-class status in any institution?
Yes.
Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense. I grew up Methodist myself, but when you read the whole of the Bible instead of just the snippets that are the prepared, planned speech for the week and the readings for the week, you notice that most women go to Christian churches and completely ignore St. Paul's instructions to cover their heads, and most Christian denominations ignore the abjuration that women shouldn't speak in church. They're now letting them become preachers or bishops or fairly high up in the hierarchy. And you think at the root of the religious books in the Christian orthodoxy is that man was created first and woman was created to be a helpmate and a servant to him and is always lesser because, hence covering the head in church or not speaking in church, because man's head is in God but woman's head is in man. And so,
see, that kind of stuff is just—it's just like who wants to sign up for that?
Yes.
If you're a woman,
you know? And does it lead to internalized misogyny and conflicts for women when you're brought up in a church and you read that and your holy book says you're always going to be lesser? You're here as a servant.
I don't see how it can't. And this is Ember Laura. It's nice to talk to you.
Hi.
I grew up in a fairly irreligious household, but my dad grew up very Catholic. We're Italian, so you know it's just part of the lifestyle. And you know, growing up, he would teach me about Catholicism and explain things to me, you know, things that the differences between men and women and things like that. And I think through him explaining that to me, a young girl, and realizing how limiting it was, it really turned him off from the church. And it really stopped any kind of religious lessons that him and I were having unless I wanted them. And at that point, you know, the Bible scared me as a kid. And I've always been really sensitive, but it scared me and I didn't like the differences between men and women. And it wasn't something that was a value in my home. So it stopped. And so I can see how when you get into these comparative religion classes, you know, it's a little shocking the differences between the school of Judaism you grew up in.
And well, I think one of the things that was really inspiring to me, so in college, as I was studying comparative religion and other things, I was also really pushing the administration with another group of women to get us a women's studies program. Mm-hmm. And we succeeded, but after I graduated, that's another story. But but they did see that, you know, we were clamoring to have the curriculum expanded so we could be reading feminist critiques of things like religion. So I did. They did bring in a woman professor who brought a feminist critique, and it was fantastic. And so we read Rosemary Ruther and Judith Plaskow and Mary Daly. And these women seem to have developed into two camps. And one, the Rosemary Ruther and Judith Plaskow camp, said, you know, like, we should reform these traditional religions, these patriarchal religions. We should stay in it and reform from within. And then you had the revolutionary Mary Daly, who had been a Catholic nun. She taught at Boston College and, you know, really was a fighter, an amazing, amazing writer and prophet. And she was saying, forget it. You know, you can't reconcile those patriarchal religions with feminism. You're just going to sell out, you know. Go be a hag. Go do your own thing.
That was this is Una Nowling. That was one of the things that troubled me as I was searching for faith throughout my life. And I tried many different religions, so to speak. I spoke to the, you know, religious officials at the churches. I read, I studied, and so forth. And even when I had finally decided to work on what it would be to be a Buddhist, and this was very much reinforced by my first trip to Thailand, which, of course, you know, it's a 95 or 98% Buddhist country, and it's just so in-depth and ingrained, and it seems like it works, is that I started to discover that there was a bit of, you know, it may not be as severe as some other major religions, but there was misogyny in Buddhism, and it started the seed of doubt in me again, and it was really disappointing to see that.
Well, it's great that you bring that up, because Buddhism was the thing that I just totally fell in love with in college, and I went to Sri Lanka and Thailand my sophomore year, and studied and then became a Vipassana meditator. And then after college, I went back on this Watson Fellowship as part of this kind of tour of places where women were practicing patriarchal traditional religions, to really talk to women and find out, so why have you chosen this? But not in a, I mean, the why question can be very, make people defensive, but more like, so yes. Show me, how does this work for you? Mm-hmm. How does this nurture you? How does this nourish your spiritual side, bring you closer to God, if that's what you want, or enlightenment? And so it was, I developed a more respectful approach, so I was young. So let's forgive me when I first started or saying, oh, why in the world would anyone want to do this? But as I met actual people, actual humans who are doing it, and in my own religion, at the yeshiva, seeing that, yes, every one of these traditions has sexism because these are traditions that were man-made. Mm-hmm. All our religions are man-made. And so all the biases, gender biases, and power dynamics come into it. And yet, within each tradition, there can be liberating narratives. And that includes in Thailand, although Buddhism, Theravadan Buddhism in particular, which is Southeast Asia, does have the idea that one must be reborn as a man in order to become enlightened, which I find incredibly offensive and wrong. There were many things that Buddha said that contradicted that, as reported by men. I mean, Buddha never wrote anything. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think we see that across all sorts of religions and denominations. I mean, if you think about Christianity, there's so many different forms of Christianity. I grew up in the South, so we had Southern Baptists, which are completely different from Methodists and Presbyterians and, everything in between. And so I imagine with Buddhism, you have Theravadins and Buddhism. I can't remember the other ones. I was a religion major in college also, and I don't remember, and I'm sorry.
Mahayana, and there's the Zen or Chan Buddhism. Mm-hmm. Tibetan Buddhism, yeah.
But isn't Mahayana, is that also known as the Great Vehicle?
Yeah. I mean, Theravada is known as, Thera means also great, Maha means great, they all claiming primacy. Right. Theravadin is considered the older tradition. It was spread throughout Southeast Asia from India by the King Asoka, the 5th century BC. And then when it spread to China, there's a process of syncretism, so it's blending with the things that already exist, ideas that already exist. And then Mahayana was developed. It has a more, I would say the main difference is Theravadin, you are working on your own enlightenment, your own personal enlightenment. And once you achieve that, you are out of the cycle of rebirth. You're finished. And rebirth, of course, is seen as suffering, so that's a good thing. Right. And with Mahayana, when you achieve enlightenment, you come back as a bodhisattva, which is like a saint, saintly person who helps others then achieve enlightenment. So that's kind of, and they have a kind of their own pantheon.
Yes, when we were in Thailand, we actually saw a Chinese Buddhist temple in Thailand that was for the bodhisattva Kuan Yin or Gin Yi. And several different mm-hmm. pronunciations depending on the country.
Kuan Im, Guan Yin, it's all, they call her the mother goddess as a slang, or at least our friends there in Thailand who took us around did. And
and that fits in with the you have to be reborn as a man before you can reach enlightenment idea, because they started out as a male, and when they were about to ascend to enlightenment, they heard the suffering of the whole world, and they decided to remain and not go to full enlightenment, and they became a woman because they felt that a woman would be able to deal with the suffering and help people more, and particularly to help women in childbirth and with children and all the suffering for them that wasn't being addressed at the time.
But that's a wonderful example of how we claim and change patriarchal and really any tradition. We claim it and then we change it. We make it the empowering narrative that we need. That was exactly what I looked at in my year abroad, my year and a half through the Watson Foundation. How were women claiming and changing traditions? And it was really interesting. I lived in Finland with a group of Catholic nuns, and they were part of the French order, which translates to the Little Sisters of Jesus Christ. And they wore denim. They wore denim habits and played guitar. They were really groovy. And
wow,
they,
cool nuns.
They had taken, yeah, nice. And their vow was to kind of give comfort to the poor and working class. So they went out in the morning to work in factories. and be among the people. But they had built their own little convent and sauna, because we were in Finland, and their own looms, so they would weave things. I mean, they were exactly like my lesbian feminist best friends who were living on women's land in Maine. They made themselves a fantastic women's space.
I'm getting this image of a terrible B movie, you know, nuns in a hot tub.
Well, it's funny because that was a little bit, you know, it was sort of beautiful and odd to go into a sauna with nuns. And then I also lived in a Russian Orthodox convent in outside of Paris, about an hour south of Paris.
That must have been really fascinating.
It was so interesting. And there are so many stories, but Russian Orthodoxy is extremely patriarchal. They have literally the patriarch. And the priest would come to do the mass on Sundays. And, of course, the whole... we were in a chateau that had been converted into a convent. So my little room was above the stables, and I got to help out in the kitchen. Oh, and I also got to burn the holy garbage, which were the wafers that had been consecrated but not used.
Hmm.
So it was really, you know, kind of a surreal thing. And I was younger than everyone there by at least 60 years. I mean, it was really it was a funny place. But when the priest came, the nuns were, you know, I have to say, irritated. Like, they had a nice thing going there. And then he would come in and it was grumbling, you know, like, ugh, that guy, you know.
I can relate to that.
I know. So here I was seeing, you know, women making space for themselves and living the spiritual lives in women's space that they wanted. And, you know, I came to respect that they were called to something that I could not understand. I'm not a person of faith. And that not every woman is going to be Mary Daly and be able to step out on the edge and live in that radical space. As a Jew, we don't have a monastic tradition. So it was very foreign to me, this idea that you would not, you know, have a family or live in family. And because Jews experience diaspora and, you know, for so long we're spread out around the world and we didn't have any central rabbinic authority, religion happened at home. You know, in most places there wasn't a synagogue. You were just with your family, maybe some neighbors were Jewish.
I wonder,
probably not.
I imagine that, you know, because of the diaspora of Jewish people and because they have, you said the religion is at home, how that reflects, like, how it evolves and how it becomes more equitable, because you're seeing it more, how it relates directly to you and your family rather than, you know, the community. It gets smaller, and so I wonder if that makes it more, I don't know, it makes it heavier in some ways for people. Like, they realize that...
I think it's a little bit harder to change your role. The gender roles are so... explicit. Judaism is very old. I mean, of course, it predates Christianity, it predates Islam. You know, those religions are built on Judaism. And so you're bringing a lot of very old ideas that have been modernized. Obviously, women are no longer seen as chattel and then only have the one wife. And, you know, and Judaism has this really surprising and lively thread of feminism. Like, a woman can actually divorce her husband if she's not sexually satisfied. Unfortunately, it's the only time a woman can divorce the husband. Otherwise, the husband has to give the divorce.
Hmm.
But I think that's really interesting. There's this really strong entitlement unlike in Catholicism, where women and their bodies are seen as sort of dirty, And in Catholicism in general, you're supposed to rise above the physical to the spiritual.
Right.
In Judaism, we don't have that kind of split. That's why we don't have a celibate tradition of monks and nuns. Spirituality comes through all the experiences of being a household person, of having a body and being sexual, having your period.
I think I only know, like, historical Judaism, because I remember learning about things about women being unclean and not being allowed to cross running water and having to have ritual bath purification afterwards.
That's not really the, Yeah, that, I mean, there's because we're talking about a tradition that's so old, you know, and also there's been a lot of change. I mean, it's too long to get into, but I'm sure there are some sexist views that are still held. I know there are. But I would say in general for, like, let's say Orthodox women, and especially what I discovered, you know, attending this yeshiva, they felt very empowered. And again, they had a lot of women's space. There's a separation of the genders to protect what they call tzniut, which is like a privacy, or what would they call it? Like, what's a better word than primness? You know, keeping yourself sort of modesty. Thanks. Mm-hmm. That's the word I was looking for. For modesty, you know, women kind of socialize with men and men socialize with men. So here again, I'm in this women's space and women are dancing, singing together. I felt like, wow, it's really interesting how at home this feels as, you know, a feminist.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things I came away with, aside from sort of my own maturing sense of just wonderment and non-judgment about how other women choose to lead spiritual lives, is I came to really appreciate how, you know, change only happens through enlightened men allowing it. I mean, that's how women got the vote. Of course, women pushed for it and advocated for and articulated it, but it was men who voted to give us the vote. Like, we've been given our power by men because of the way societies have been structured, especially Western societies. We can't just go in and take it. You know, we constantly have to, what should I say, we can't be separatists the way, you know, for a certain part of my young womanhood, I thought, you know, who needs them? No, it's absolutely important. It's absolutely essential, and it's absolutely beautiful to have male allies. And I came away with that, and then I started to think about myself as an ally. And this has been a burning passion for me since then. What kind of ally am I being, you know, to women of color, to all people of color, to people with disabilities, to transgender people, to people who aren't as privileged and fortunate as I am? And where are the places where I can use that power to help others? And that's just been, you know, so now when I think of feminism and I think of intersectional feminism, I get so happy. Do you guys feel that way?
Yes, I love the intersectionalism idea, and that it examines and gives extra voice to people who for so long have often been kept quiet, even within feminism. There's the Me Too thing that started, and everyone was like, hey, she did this really great idea, and then people of color stood up and said, hey, this happened over a decade ago and no one was listening. And
yeah.
And people gave credit where credit was due and said, it's been ignored for this long, but it's really important. They founded it. This woman actually created it, and we're standing on the shoulders of giants.
And I think that when we think about the history of feminism, you know, starting at the suffragettes and moving forward, there can sometimes be this riff among feminists now of, you know, do we revere these women as idols? And how do we talk about, you know, the racism and, you know, the classism that occurred within these movements? How do we both thank these women for the path that they've started and learn from it in a way that's constructive? And I think it's caused a lot of intergenerational problems among feminists. And I'm a relatively young feminist, and so I try to, you know, do the best I can to find that balance of having a thanks and appreciation without blindly accepting things that were not okay that happened in that movement.
It's interesting you say that, because at Swarthmore College is where Alice Paul was a student, and Alice Paul was in a way the culprit during the suffragette movement. I think the suffrage movement. I don't like that et. The suffrage movement. when black women came to her and said, we want to be part of this, and she said, no, because I think, you know, for strategic reasons, it'll be harder for us to get it. And that no, you know, is what created, I think, a lot of this pain, and it was the wrong thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And at Swarthmore, when I was there, we were celebrating our, I can't remember, some birthday or anniversary of Alice Paul or of our Women's Center. I can't remember. It was the Alice Paul Women's Center. And we thought, oh, well, let's have a program where we actually make, you know, be transparent. Let's talk about this. Let's bring it up. Let's have a whole conversation. And so we invited a black feminist named Marion Barry, lovely woman, brilliant woman from Washington, D.C. And we sent a message to the Black Cultural Center on campus and said, hey, this is happening. And we were feeling all good about ourselves. And, of course, no black women came to the program.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a wonderful program. And as I was driving Dr. Barry back to the train, and I kind of said, you know, I'm just disappointed. Like, where are the black women? And, you know, why aren't they part of the Women's Center? And why didn't they come? And she gave me a great lesson. And she said, well, you know, it's better when you work in coalition. I mean, isn't that kind of the whole lesson of what happened with Alice Paul? She didn't reach out and say, so what's your interest and how can we work together? What would you, you know, instead it was like, yes, you can come to our party. No, you can't come to our party. And that we had just replicated that same process. Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't check to see if the Black Cultural Center was having its own event that night, which in fact it was, or if they wanted to hear a conversation or who they would have invited, you know, so I think those are the lessons, and I think it's okay to have made those mistakes as long as we learn from them, which is, I think, why being an ally, the position of being an ally is the position of being someone who is really respectful. Like, I don't come in as the expert. I come in as, you know, a listener.
Absolutely. And, you know, yeah. And I think, too, you know, not that that modern feminism or whatever we want to call it is blameless. Not at all. It's moving more towards being intersectional, and there are more intersectional feminist groups and feminist ideas and theories. And but, you know, a lot of feminism is very focused on being very proud of womanhood, and I think that's a great thing, but I think a lot of what happens in that is that we kind of get into this binary of men and women, and that womanhood is defined by female traits, and it becomes this kind of transgender exclusionary, icky kind of place that can be really, really harmful. And I think a lot of it is accidental. A lot of it is not understanding that, like, you know, taking your femininity from your anatomy and your womanhood from your anatomy is really deductive, but some of it is really intentionally harmful too. And I think that that's another part of this. And I'm thinking about it as we're talking about religion, how our understanding of gender changes is going to change how I think religions move forward with those binary gender roles. And so that's something that is really interesting to me.
Some of the older
I love that you brought that up too, because I think the transgender movement is a wonderful challenge for everyone to think about these things. You know, is my femininity in my, you know, sex organs? Is it in my presentation? And does it matter? You know, we're in the postmodern world. Like, I remember there was a young man I met in London who presented as female. And I kind of said to him, but, you know, before I knew much about transgender, I said, but it makes no sense to call yourself female because you're not. And he said, how do you, you know, who's to say what female is? And I felt so threatened by that. I said, well, if we take that away, then how do we fight for any change? How do we fight for any equality? And he said, yeah, but if you take that away, everyone's equal. So, I mean, of course, it's not true, but it's also true. Does that make sense? Like,
yes, it's true at its foundation, because you couldn't distinguish between people being male and female, then you couldn't be sexist against men and women. But we would find other things to be bigoted against anyway.
Right.
But, and also that idea of feminism and womanhood being important, that can also harm cisgender women as well, because if they're defining themselves by their tendency to nurture and to mother, if you don't have a maternal bone in your body, it's like, so what am I then? I'm just thrown out with the bathwater?
Right, and again, it's reducing...
I just feel like those become really false arguments. I don't think we need to define, and in any narrow and limited way, what female is. I think what we need to define in a very specific way is what equality is.
Right.
And so why limit anybody? Why limit men? Patriarchy hurts men, too. Why
That's
say
a really good
this is,
point.
I mean, I feel this, because I've been out as a lesbian since I was a teenager, I have not felt constrained by gender roles. So for me, it just makes perfect sense. So how I live, but I can see in the world, the issue isn't, are you feminine enough or masculine enough? The issue is, are we all given our human rights? Are we all given our human dignity? Are we treated with love and respect? That's the fundamental piece. The rest is just distraction. It's fluff to me.
I remember,
if you wear lipstick, could you, you know, you're a traitor to the cause. No, but it's really good to have a great critique of what the beauty industry means as right. far as women's self-esteem, and then make your own choice.
Yes. And a lot of the time also people dismiss people who are younger because they haven't got the experience, so they think they don't know what they're talking about. But something like fairness and being treated fairly is really easy to see as a child, and then as you get older you tend to see shades of grey more. When I was a kid, I frequently would get cut in front of in lines, or people would see me there and they would serve people that were older behind me, and it was just because I was a kid, and it's like, I was here first. You see justice and you feel injustice mm-hmm. very strongly as a child, and then mm-hmm. a lot of the time that fades away because you get, I guess, so much of it happens,
you get old and tired and bitter.
Not that that would describe any of us today.
I don't know, I may be feeling a bit tired or stringy today.
This is making me think of so many interesting things, you guys. This is a really interesting conversation. You do this every Saturday? You guys get together and talk to feminists like this?
Yes. Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Including feminist males.
Excuse me?
Including feminist males.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
I reported a story a few years ago for our NPR station. We have a women's commission here in Tucson, and the chair of the women's commission was a man. And I thought, what?
Wow.
So I interviewed some leaders from different women's leadership organizations like the YW and Girl Scouts. What do you guys think of this? And then I went and talked to this young man who was a lovely guy. And the best response I got, and he even said, I know, this is ridiculous, but nobody else wanted to do it. You know, so I said, okay, I'll do it. But the best response I got was from the head of the University of Arizona's Women's Studies Department, or Gender Studies Department, Laura Briggs. And I said, does this upset you? And, like, does it upset you that the Women's Studies has now become Gender Studies and you've got all these men teaching in the department? And she said, look, if men want to pick up an oar and row the boat forward, I say, yes, let's let them. And I thought, that's fantastic. But at what point, and I think of this as the same question to myself as a white person, and in, you know, being an ally to people of color, at what point are you an ally, and at what point are you co-opting things?
Right.
And I think that's just such an interesting line. I don't know if you all have given that much thought.
I have, from the standpoint of the transgender community, where you have very... You can have a significant number of very well-meaning cisgender activists that can, by accident or incident, or sometimes because they are the best person to speak, they can effectively take the microphone away from mm-hmm. the people that are supposed to be the focus of the action and the activity. And that debate just rages on continuously in the transgender community. Do we have enough voice? To what extent is our voice taken from us? But there are many very strong, militant, fierce cisgender activists that live for the trans community, like my wife Fiona, for instance. And so we certainly don't want them to no longer be involved. We certainly need to be able to draw strength from them. But just, you make an excellent point. You know, you have to watch out for the people that are co-opting the community. And I've run into quite a few of those here, even within the Kansas City area, people that they wanted their space at the microphone. They want to raise some money for their private cause or so forth. And maybe some of that in the end gets funneled back to the people they're supposed to be helping, or maybe it sends them on, you know, a junket to a conference in Vienna or something.
I've noticed that sometimes there's some writers, for example, in the New York Times, I think Nicholas Kristof a few years ago started writing this really feminist stuff. But it wasn't anything that feminists had been writing elsewhere, but he was a man writing it in the New York Times, and suddenly he was this celebrated feminist man.
Right.
And it was so irritating, yet on the other hand, he was using his platform to promote these ideas that I cherish.
I feel the same way about Jackson Katz. He's done research and talked about the role of men in ending violence, and he gets up and does a TED Talk, and everyone's like, oh my God, Jackson Katz. And I like the guy. I have no problem with him, but it's like, if a woman got up and said that, we'd be like, all right, like, cool.
We've heard this 5,000 times before, and it hasn't changed anything.
And I think, I'm sure that that's probably a similar experience among people of color, people with disabilities, people, you know, of all different marginalized groups. And I myself have, you know, I've attended, a meeting for, and this is going to sound bad when I start saying it, so, but it was about racial justice for white people. So it was for white people or people who identified as white to learn about racial justice and kind of how that worked nationally and locally, and kind of basically racism 101 for white people. And what it ended up being was a lot of well-intentioned millennials who were white trying to learn about all of this. But the leadership was all white. Everyone who was there was white. And there was, you know, a board of people of color who were consulted. But the whole thing to me felt really uncomfortable. And I don't know why. I can't exactly say why. But it kind of, the rule that I always try to use is I try to be an amplifier for people, not a microphone. So I'm just trying to repeat what they're saying, and to understand it better rather than coming to my own conclusions and saying, you know, this is what's really great for this group I'm not a part of, but I really support.
That reminds me of the cover of Time, because the person of the year this year was the Me Too women, or the victims that have come forward and spoken out. But if I remember correctly, every single woman on the cover of that magazine was white.
We have to be so...
I may be misremembering, but
I don't know. I mean, it wouldn't shock me.
Yeah. It wouldn't shock me either. The best thing that I've ever learned in my own journey to look at my racism, and I don't know if it's ever possible to completely eradicate it, but to definitely continue to make that effort and be mindful and aware and sensitive, is came from I trained as a family therapist in my journalism career, because I was writing about the mental health fields, and I love systems change and thinking about that, so family therapy is a perfect fit. And there's a wonderful family therapist in New York named Ken Hardy, and he's African-American, and he teaches a lot about racism, and especially teaches a lot of white people about how to think about racism. And one time he said, look, you don't do this work, anti-racism work, for me. If you do it for me, we're lost. Because this shouldn't be altruistic, because you can't trust altruism. You can pick and choose the day you want to be altruistic. You do this out of self-interest. Mm-hmm. You do this because this is the world you want to live in. And if you do that, then you're a trustworthy ally.
I appreciate
because
that.
I know. Frame. Yeah, because then guilt is irrelevant. Guilt is the most useless thing ever. Guilt makes you feel like you're doing something, but you're doing nothing at all, except you're in a narcissistic spin about how you feel. It does nothing for anybody else. So the whole notion of white guilt is just a narcissistic spin. This is what I'm saying. But what he was saying just made perfect sense. If you are acting out of self-interest because you want to live in a world where everyone's safe, because you want to live in a world where you can greet every other human being without that awkward thing, and where you know that they're well and you're well and you're interested and curious about each other, and not just seeing difference and not objectifying and othering. If that's the world you want to live in, great, here's a path. You know, that's why you do this.
Mm-hmm. And guilt often does the opposite. It puts people's backs up and makes them defensive and makes them drive people away and drive a wedge and instead of motivating
them to do something. Well, it makes black people have to take care of you. Oh, my God, I feel guilty. Yes. No, don't feel guilty. It's another burden. It doesn't help anybody in any guilt, not just between, you know, black people and white people, but feeling guilty in general doesn't move you anywhere.
And hating men because they have more power, more representation doesn't get you anywhere. It just puts up the back of potential allies.
Right.
I do feel there's a place for anger, though. I mean, I hear you about the hate for sure, but I still get outraged. Well, I'm sure you all get outraged every time you read the paper. But, I mean, the outrage is fuel, but it's not a useful fuel if it's just, if that's all it is. You know what I mean? It can be an energizer, I guess, like I would say.
Right.
It might get you up off your butt and started, but it doesn't usually power you to keep going.
Correct.
Well, while we're talking about intersections and power and motivation, I believe you helped organize the Buddhist nuns when you were in Sri Lanka or in Thailand.
Yeah, this was such an interesting moment. So I was still on my Watson fellowship, and I was in Sri Lanka, which is a place that I had lived a few years before, and I had a little motorcycle because it was a, you know, convenient way to go from village to village. And I was talking to village nuns, because village nuns, nuns in Theravada Buddhism, are not equal to the monks. They don't have the higher ordination. So they don't have the same level of community support. I mean, tax dollars in Sri Lanka go to support the male sangha or community of monks, but not nearly that amount will go to the nuns. And so it's, you know, political issue. And there used to be higher ordination for nuns in Sri Lanka, but it somehow died off. Historians were looking at that. But I met a nun who was organizing other Buddhist nuns in the mountain region around Kandy to kind of get together and talk about doing something. So she rode around with me on the back of my little motorcycle, and we went from village to village inviting nuns to come into the city of Kandy, and we were going to sponsor a day of, you know, like a little conference. And, but of course, you know, we promised them lunch because that was the big motivator. So they all came, and we gave them bus fare. And I was able to use my fellowship money for some of this, which was great. And then when they came, you know, we had some speeches from various people, and I gave a little talk that was translated because my Sinhala is not that good. And then this young woman gets up, and she has something she'd like to say. She probably was, I don't know, 25, which was rare because most of the Buddhist nuns in Sri Lanka, it's like a second career. It's after the kids are grown. Many of them come out of abusive relationships to become nuns. But she was young, and she got up, and she retold the story of how the Sangha, the community of nuns, first came about. This is a Theravadan story. And it is that when Buddha was born, his mother died giving birth. And so he was raised by another woman, by his stepmother. And when he became enlightened and was the Buddha, she came to him and she said, I want to become a nun. You know, all these women, we are here. We would like to become a nun. And he said, look, it can't be done. You know, it just goes against convention. Society would rise up against us. We can't have women, you know, and men living this way. It's not going to work. And so the nuns came, according to this young woman, she said, so the next day they came back to him again and they said, hey, we need our own sangha. We need higher ordination. We want to achieve enlightenment. And the Buddha again said, no, can't do it. And so the third time it came back, according to this young nun, they said to the Buddha, look, we're already a Sangha. We really don't need you to make us a Sangha. But while we're here, why don't you just give us the higher ordination? So he did. So I love that story because it was about the women taking the power into their own hands. And, you know, the Buddha was giving them a, just kind of like the his seal of approval, but he wasn't creating the community of nuns. He wasn't creating them. They did it themselves. And I thought, what a fantastic, I have no idea where she came up with this story or if this is a story that's told among nuns there. It's the only time I've ever heard it. But I just love it. I think it's a lesson for all of us. You know, you don't wait for permission.
I love that story too. And I think that I'd like to move on now to you also write stories. And I've been reading the first book of The Sky Guard, and I've deliberately stopped halfway through so I wouldn't accidentally do any spoilers on the air. But how does your feminist thinking and your interest come out in your books? How do these themes of feminism and change play out in your writing, and how can they influence people?
Well, thank you for reading Book of the Sky God. That's always fun. You know, I wanted to I read a lot of young adult fiction. I edit a lot of young adult fiction, but mostly I have lots of young adult nieces and nephews at the time when I wrote this. And I wanted a book for them. I wanted to write a book for them that kind of, in a way, composted a lot of the things that I think about our evolution as human beings. And, you know, this was a time of Harry Potter was really popular, and I and many others always felt like, what a wonderful series, and isn't Hermione really the star of this thing?
Yes.
The brains and the power, and didn't Hermione save the world? So I wanted to write a book with really strong young women. And I also knew, just from knowing the market of young adult fiction, and that books that really were mostly about girls would only be read by girls. And that's the sexism of, you know, of our culture, that boys don't read books generally that have girl characters. So what I decided to do, the other thing was that there's this very male idea of, you know, being the one, you know, the savior, the boy. And I thought, what if, you know, that's really not, for me, a feminist idea. I like the synergy of relationship of the group. And we can each be outstanding and amazing, but I think together, well, I mean, together we're stronger, I suppose, you know, the slogan of it. But so I came up with this, and then, of course, I'm really interested in family dynamics as a family therapist. So I came up with my five main characters who saved the world, and three of them are siblings, and three of them are girls, and two of them are boys. I deliberately start the book with the boys, knowing that boy readers need that. And girls will read about boys, and boys won't read about girls, generally speaking. But really, I think the three girl characters are all very different. They're very oppositional. They can be difficult. They're not waiting for boys to save them or kiss them or like them. They have crushes, but it's, you know, but they're also wise. And I think all those things for me are about how do you write as a feminist. Mm-hmm. The story itself, there's a great moment, which I will spoil a little bit at the end, where one of the characters has it out with these group of very sexist men and basically says, yeah, you were expecting the one and you were expecting it to be a him. You weren't expecting me. And it's just this great moment where I get to have my say to religion.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah. It all kind of goes back to that too. I took a British literature and religion class in college, which everyone called the Harry Potter class. So we read C.S. Lewis, we read Tolkien, we read his Dark Materials by Philip Pullman, and we read Harry Potter. And they all have that one and it's all a male character. And that's really what I was thinking about when you're talking about it, how this all comes together in a little bow.
But when you were talking, I was thinking of Susan Cooper and her Dark is Rising series. And although
I love that, yeah.
Yeah, and it's a group of people that are needed. All of them together come together at the end for Silver on the Tree. All of them are needed, their talents and their powers, including the girl with the two brothers.
Right.
But she's a woman and she writes, the main character that's supported by the group is male. But there's also really important female characters in it. But she's got that thing, the hook of getting the boys in there reading, so everyone gets to read it and see everyone working together and everyone mm-hmm. having their own skills and things in it. And just that really echoed with me suddenly when you were just saying about everyone working together as a team.
Mm. But around page 100 of my book, I introduce a pan-gendered character.
Hmm.
This character is every gender. And which was really interesting to write.
This is Pax.
I can't give more away without spoiling it, but
okay.
I'll just say.
Yes, I have reached that page. I just asked the name of the character if that was... I don't think saying the name of the character, because you don't find his name actual, their name actual later.
Right.
Pax.
We should have bleeped it. But it's too late.
Right.
Now.
Yes.
Right, the name was Pax.
Yes,
exactly.
That was the character.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I did that on purpose, too. And then the one of the characters assigns a gender just for ease of conversation. And I really struggled with that. And I wanted this character to assign a female gender because I thought, well, why not? Because it's hard to write it all the time. We don't have that that third gender neutral
A lot of people use they, but it's not singular, and it gives some grammarians absolute fits when it's used for a singular person. But it is evolving and changing.
Exactly.
Like language.
Exactly. Exactly. And for me, as a copy editing things, I would flinch each time. So, but I did end up, the character did end up assigning he. I don't know if I wrote the book again, if I would do it that way again. I would say that's a thing in the book that I still have a question of Mark and myself about. Did I capitulate to the patriarchy there? I don't know.
I think he said that it reminded them of their uncle. So
exactly,
that was why they
exactly.
picked
But
him
I
out.
Could have just as easily said it reminded her of her aunt. I mean,
yeah.
All I'm saying is, like, it was a choice at the moment, maybe the unfeminist moment in the book.
The times of gender relations, gender awareness, and so forth are changing so quickly that with some folks, they've almost said, with some other authors have said, that the book they wrote just 3 or 4 years ago was a product of their times, which is astonishing
right.
if you think of the short time frame.
And that's another mm-hmm. thing I thought of mm-hmm. for young adult books. How on earth do you keep it interesting and current? Because if you have any cultural references in it, people look at it and go, well, that's so last year, or everything moves so quickly.
You know, but sometimes I think it's fun to read a book that's not of your time. There are so many great writers who write books about the 70s or about the, you know, earlier times. And so I think I'm just going to trust the reader. If the story is good enough, they'll go with it. Also, my book did have a little bit of a problem, which is...
Oh, yes. 2015.
It references that Mayan prophecy about 2012, and the book actually had a publisher, Macmillan. It's a long story, but at any rate... And they were worried that it would be too short-lived, like it wouldn't have enough shelf life. So, you know, at a certain point, you just write the book you're going to write and trust the reader. It hasn't come up as a problem with the people who have, you know, read it given me feedback so far.
We're nearly out of time, so I have one quick question for you, because you have an Indian family in there, and there's been a lot of discussion online and in the press recently about own voices and sensitivity readers. So how did you make sure that your discussion of the Indian family wasn't overstepping bounds or becoming a caricature?
Wow, that's a big question for one.
I know.
Uh-huh.
Sorry.
Well, you know, I lived with South Asian family. I mean, they're still my family. I see them all the time. So the cadence of the voices, the relationships, you know, are built on real things. And then they read it, and they loved it. They thought it was, they saw themselves, they were laughing. So I felt that I was very respectful, and I wasn't inventing out of whole cloth, out of stereotype, but out of experience.
That's wonderful. And thank you so much for being with us today and being our guest.
It's been an incredible journey through comparative religions and feminism and young adult fiction. I mean, it's just really...
It's a wild ride.
I know. It's wonderful. I love it.
You have all been so delightful. Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity and wish you all the best.
We'd like to have you on again sometime in the future, if that's okay.
And where can our listeners go to learn more about you?
My Book of the Sky God, you can find the website, bookoftheskygod.com, and it's also on Amazon. And my website is lauramarkowitz.com. You'll find a lot of my radio, my radio and TV clips are there, and my editing business. I dumped all my stuff about me on there. So it's Laura Markowitz. It's MarkowitzV.com.
Perfect.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. And I wish you all the best. Thanks. Happy New Year.
Thank you.
Thank you too.
You
too.
Bye-bye.
You have been listening to Every Woman, ably engineered by Christina Fraser. Yes, she was entirely over there, so she kept quiet because she was concentrating. Hosted by me, Fiona Nowling, my wife, Una Nowling, Ember Urbach, and we were joined by our guest today, Laura Markowitz. Please stay tuned for Urban Connections with Donna Wolf and Guess Who's Coming to Kansas City with MC Richardson. And tune in next week for another episode of Every Woman.